Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sanctions imposed on Vladimir Putin's inner circle and officials in the new Crimean government in response to Russia's annexation of Crimea. With Senator John McCain, who wants a far more significant response, deriding Obama's response, saying that sanctioning only seven Russians is wholly inadequate at this stage. We'll look into whether these targeted sanctions will work to punish Putin and deter him from going after more of Ukraine's territory. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us. Then we'll examine evidence so far in the mysterious disappearance of the Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777 and its 239 crew and passengers, and speak with Dr. R. John Hansman, who is a professor in the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT and head of its Humans and Automation Division, as well as director of the International Center for Air Transportation. We'll discuss the latest speculation about what might have happened to the airliner and what evidence exists to support the growing number of theories about the fate of the plane and its passengers. Then finally, we'll speak with an active airlines pilot, Patrick Smith, who blogs at askthepilot.com and is the author of Cockpit Confidential, everything you need to know about air travel, questions, answers, and reflections. We'll discuss the Malaysian government's current focus on the airliner's crew and the possibility of suicide as a motive, as was the case in an earlier incident in 1999 when an EgyptAir Boeing 767 passenger jet leaving JFK Airport was deliberately crashed into the sea by a member of the flight crew. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And, Scott, the sanctioning, as I mentioned in the opening, of seven Russian officials, some in Putin's inner circle, others in the Duma, and the rest either Ukrainian or Crimean officials, have already been greeted with derision by Senator John McCain. What do you think will be the impact of these sanctions?
Well, I think we're going to look at a steadily ratcheting series of sanctions coming in. The first sanctions that are being discussed are very, very narrowly targeted on individuals in immediate proximity to Putin and individuals who have otherwise played a significant role in the transfer of Crimea to Russia. I think that there is much to be said for these sorts of sanctions. I mean, generally, of course, in Washington, the neoconservatives have ridiculed sanctions as a tool, have dismissed them as ineffective, but studies that have been done over time looking at sanctions in places like Iraq and Iran, and in many other cases, including the historical sanctions levied against apartheid South Africa, have showed that actually sanctions were reasonably effective in almost all of these cases, but they had some negative aspects, particularly if we look at the sanctions in Iraq. They affected children. They affected the flow of medications. So the tendency now is to start the process with much more narrowly focused sanctions. And here they're going after the immediate Putin entourage, and they're going after they basically want to make their lives less pleasant, preclude them from being able to travel to the West, own property in the West, or do business outside the country. And I think these sanctions will be effective in achieving that, because it won't just be the United States. It'll also be the European Union and a number of other countries that will join in.
Well, of course, already Vladislav Surkov is known as the Grey Cardinal. He's Putin's presidential aide. It's not going to affect him. His only connections to America are Allen Ginsberg and Jackson Pollock. So I don't quite know what he means by that. But the others, and including, of course, the Duma member, Yelena Mezlina, who wrote the anti-gay law, she again have said, well, I never go to America and I don't have any property there. So the Europeans have sanctioned 21 individuals, which for the EU to agree on anything, given the disparity amongst the nations, is pretty significant. But again, that was a list of 120 down to 21. So there seems to be a lot of caution, if not confusion, here.
Yeah, but I think we'll see the list and we'll see the sanctions grow over time. I think that there's a clear plan that this be ratcheted step by step. And yes, it's easy for them to say we don't travel to the United States. Well, in fact, actually, an awful lot of the elite class of Russians do travel to the United States. But far beyond that, the Grey Cardinal insisted he didn't have bank accounts outside of Russia. And let me just express a firm doubt about that. Most of the Russian elites today have exported most of their capital outside of the country, and they control it mostly through European and offshore institutions. Those who've arrived and become members of the Russian elite tend to send their children to be educated in Switzerland or England. They tend to have apartments and country homes in England or around Geneva or Zurich and other locations. So these sanctions will definitely affect them. In fact, if you take an inventory of yachts that are now docked in the Porte d'Azur in France, you'll find a majority of the yachts are in the hands of Russian oligarchs.
But they so far have not been sanctioned, right? I mean, these are the people that commingle Putin's ill-gotten gains. He's allegedly one of the richest people in the world. That's being held off. So is what's going on here, Scott Horton, the recognition that Crimea is lost and that what Putin is being warned with now is that worse will come if you take eastern Crimea, which is what he appears poised to do.
Eastern and southern Ukraine, I think.
I'm sorry, eastern and southern Ukraine. Yeah, he appears to be poised to do that. And frankly, I think he will, but that's just my opinion.
I think what drives it is a sense that military response to what's happened in Crimea is impossible to justify. But you can't fail to do anything. You have to take some sort of steps. And the steps should target those who've instigated this entire scheme. And as I said, I expect to see it become more and more over time. But I think it is going to focus on those who are responsible and not be much more broadly based, affecting the broader Russian population. But I'd say we are going to see a back and forth rhythm here. So Russia has responded immediately to the actions of the United States and to the Europeans with its own banning orders. And I think I think we may see a sort of ping pong effect back and forth. With some escalation.
But to the point, Scott Horton, that the West recognizes that Crimea is lost, but they would like to warn Putin against taking eastern Ukraine. Is that an effective way to go? Then, in other words, you do these targeted sanctions, which are targeted against a handful of his people involved in the Duma in this decision, the crooks that are now running Crimea, Aksionov, the previously known as the Goblin, a minor gangster, and Konstantinov, the Speaker of the Parliament, who's responsible for a huge real estate scam where thousands of people in a Ponzi scheme put up money for apartment buildings that were never built, and then of course Yanukovych himself. Those are the people that they've targeted now. Then that is fairly narrow. So are they holding in reserve on the back burner that we're going to go after your cronies now, Putin, if you go into eastern Ukraine?
I think there are going to be further steps, and I think you're also going to see steps taken by the European Union and the United States. They're designed to bolster and strengthen the position of Ukraine. So I think you'll see a lot of support for the Ukrainian government. Of course, this was put before the U.S. Congress and was blocked by the Republicans rather amazingly. John McCain threw a fit about that over the weekend. But, you know, I think that, that support is going to be offered and it will be important. And you know, the question is, you know, whether thresholds into military support are crossed.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So just what exactly did the Republicans block and McCain had a fit over?
Yes, well, John Kerry went to the Hill requesting funds for the Ukrainian government, basically a financial bailout that would have included security support for the government. And this was part of a package that was negotiated between the U.S., the Ukrainians, and the Europeans. It was the U.S. component. And the U.S. said, you know, leading Republicans refused to support it because provisions provided payments for the IMF and the World Bank. Of course, the main vehicle for these, for the financial support, was always going to be the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the IMF particularly.
So these Republicans want to get tough on Putin, but not do anything to help the Ukrainian people, which, you know.
Well, they're refusing to do what the Ukrainians most urgently need and have most urgently demanded.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that that's awfully petty, and I think at some point they'll relent and it'll pass after they've thrown their tantrum.
Well, what is the strategy vis-a-vis? I mean, I guess at this point everybody's on pins and needles wondering what Putin's going to do next. He's massed that army on the Ukrainian border of eastern Ukraine, and the same MO is being applied to eastern Ukraine as was to Crimea, where they send in Russian provocateurs and thugs and manufacture pogroms and keep beating the drum on the idea that the new Ukrainian government are a bunch of Nazis and anti-Semites, which, by the way, I don't understand why the U.S. and Europeans don't make this new government repudiate those people and kick them out. You know, why are they in there in any case?
Well, they are a part of the government. Of course, I'd say they're just as many neo-Nazis in Russia as there are in Ukraine. So
Right. It's
a phenomenon that's common to the entire region, and it is something of a problem and somewhat troubling. But, you know, the threat we're looking at, it's difficult to assess exactly how far Putin intends to go here. But let's say there are three potential phases. I mean, the first already taken involves reducing Crimea to Russian control and now incorporating Crimea into the Russian Federation directly. The next would be taking control over the southern and eastern provinces where a majority of the population is Russian-speaking, and there are a very, very large number of ethnic Russians. Where you note that some of the measures that were taken in Crimea seem now to be in the process of implementation. And the third would be to topple the government in Kiev itself and to install a puppet state, a sort of Prague 1968 solution. And, of course, when Yanukovych was toppled, there were papers that were seized at his residence suggesting that he and the Russian government were in the process of planning exactly that sort of maneuver. So it seems to me that that certainly can't be ruled out. And I think the response, the Western response, is going to be keyed to that. So I think, Crimea, it is much more difficult to strike aggressively against Russia, certainly to pursue a military option based on the Crimea. The bottom line is that Crimea, through most of modern history, has been part of Russia anyway. A large majority of the population is Russian. It became a part of Ukraine as a result of Nikita Khrushchev spending one evening with too much vodka and deciding he would give it as a gift to Ukraine, and Nikita, of course, being a Ukrainian. So that's always been a rather weird quirk of history. And I think the question there is not that it's rejoined to Russia, it's the way that this transpires, ignoring the Ukrainian constitution and any formal or proper process, or even really a fair and open referendum allowing people to express their real views. But I think a military action in the eastern and southern parts of Ukraine would be a far more serious development.
Well, Scott Horton, Scott Horton, professor at Columbia Law School and contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs, and he served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bono, among other activists in the former Soviet Union. I've spoken to a number of Russians and Americans who know Putin, and yesterday Masha Gessen, who wrote a book about him and had met him in the Kremlin, Bill Browder, who's the biggest investor in Russia until in 2005, he became a non-person for running afoul of Putin, and his lawyer, Magnitsky, was murdered by the regime, and the Americans have passed a measure called the Magnitsky Act that sanctions Russian officials involved in the killing of Magnitsky, and that could be expanded to Putin and others, presumably. But what I'm being told is that Putin, this is working out for him domestically, and that his MO is basically to keep the Russian public distracted from the fact that he's stealing the country blind. And Sochi was a great distraction, and now this is a great distraction, so that he could string this out for months. So what do you make of that scenario?
Well, I think that's a sound analysis, and I think Masha Gessen's book about Putin is probably the best available book about his life. It shows the circumstances in which he grew up and his training and his career. This man is a career KGB officer, and he has that training and that background. And I think quite significantly now, as these steps are being taken, he's being counseled and advised by an inner coterie of former intelligence officers, not by his foreign minister and the other senior officials of the government you think would be involved. But I think it's correct that the natural political reflex inside of Russia to the developments in Korea and the Crimea will be to cheer this and view it as a dramatic success by Putin. But I'm not so sure that 2 or 3 years down the road it's going to be viewed that way. In fact, I think at that point, if this produces a Cold War, something like a Cold War, if it produces a deterioration of Russian relations with Europe, a loss of an important Russian market, a loss of the right to the ability to travel, to take vacations in Europe, to own property there, I think people will be very upset by that. And I think they will understand that Putin is a kleptocrat. I think most of them understand that already. He's someone who has amassed enormous wealth, and the population as a whole is not benefiting. And I think he, at the outset of his rule, when he first became prime minister, he sparked the war in the North Caucasus. And he did that as a neat way of distracting from the economic shortcomings of his administration. I think we're seeing the Ukrainian operations today for more or less the same reason. I mean, he's not delivering on the promise of a wealthy and prosperous Russia. Far from it.
And the growth is going down to 1%. If indeed in the long run the Europeans find a way, because they've apparently got enough gas until next winter, but if they transition away from Russian gas to other sources in the long term, that's a huge loss for Russia. It's their main source of income. So it's nothing that he's doing is particularly in the interest of Russia in the long term, but in the short term, they've been very good for his poll numbers, and that may be all that matters with this guy and his small coterie of KGB thugs, none of whom were particularly distinguished officers, by the way. Putin's career was very undistinguished. They were much cleverer people in the KGB than he was.
That's exactly right. But I would say in the meantime, while his poll numbers on the whole may be improving or may be very good, if you look at the key indicators, Russian elites in Moscow and St. Petersburg, that was an audience that roundly supported Putin 3 years ago, and I think was the mainstay of support for his government, and they have steadily become more and more disaffected at Putin. And today they largely see him as a failed president, as very, very corrupt and not really very smart. And I think that's a very dangerous situation for him.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you.
Again, Scott Horton is a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the evidence so far in the mysterious disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777.